Today's show is brought to you by 8 Sleep. Have you noticed how many mattress companies there are recently? So many. One company is different from the rest, and it's called 8. 8 is smart. It's the iPhone compared to the flip phone. By sleeping on 8, you can discover how many hours of sleep you need each night to feel energized. Visit 8sleep.com/TETA and use the promo code TETA to get $125 off all mattresses, plus free shipping and free returns. That's 8EIGHT sleep.com/TETA to redeam this special offer. Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, executive editor of Recode.
And I'm Lauren Good, senior tech editor at The Verge.
And you're listening to Too Embarrassed to Ask, coming to you from the Vox Media Podcast Network. This is a show where we answer all of your embarrassing questions about consumer tech.
It could be anything at all, like whether Kara Swisher is here in studio for this podcast, or if it's a replicant of Kara Swisher.
I'd like to have a replicant.
Or if Kara Swisher is getting her son's Boston Dynamics robot for Christmas.
No, they just got a PlayStation 4. Oops, I just said it out loud. Anyway, there we have it. So send us your questions. Find us on Twitter or tweet them to @Recode or to myself or to Lauren with the hashtag TooEmbarrassed.
We also have an email address, although email is probably going to go away soon. If not, robots will be answering them for us. The email is tooembarrassed@recode.net. And a friendly reminder, there are two R's and S's in embarrassed. Do you think that's true? You think robots are going to be answering our emails?
Yeah, I don't think we're going to have emails, but let's move on. Hopefully we're not going to have them.
I will speak up in defense of emails.
All right, go ahead, Grammy. Okay.
No, let's not get into it now.
All right, We'll do a whole show on it.
We should do a whole... That's a great idea. Would you guys like that? If you would like that, please go to our iTunes page, leave us a review. You can tweet at us. You can go to our Facebook pages. I know I have a Facebook page.
Why aren't we taking suggestions?
Because I like input from the people, Kara.
Let's do what we want.
You're going to make a great mayor.
I'm not going to listen to anyone. I'm going to just fix the city. Anyway. Moving along.
We're back in studio together. Yes. It's great to see you again.
Yes. Yes. Good to see you.
I missed you.
I know. I was in D.C. I was in L.A. I was all over New York.
I think hanging out with podcast people.
Podcast people. I was doing some great podcasts with all women, actually, which was really interesting. Greta Van Susteren and Tina Brown, Christine Brennan, for different podcasts. It was really fun. It was great.
That's great.
And seeing my kids.
I was in Detroit.
Yeah, how was that?
I was in Massachusetts a couple times.
Good. Well, now we're here together.
And now we're here together at long last. And today on Too Embarrassed to Ask, we are delighted to have Rich Mahoney, the founder and CEO of Seismic, in studio with us.
Explain Seismic. Seismic is a wearable robotics company formerly known as Superflex, which is a fantastic name, Rich. Why did you get rid of that? I love that.
Superflex was a DARPA program, so we want to be
a... I that. It feels like a superhero.
Yeah, we can still use it. We'll find a way to use it.
I had to
still
endure Justice League over Thanksgiving because I have two sons, but thank God for Gal Gadot. She was amazing, but everyone else.
By the way, if you're going to say that you have to change your company name, it's pretty cool to say, well, that was with DARPA.
Yeah, I know.
You know,
that's
that
true.
Was the
that's
DARPA
fair.
Project.
That's fair.
So now I had to
come
up with something
else. I'm going
to
call it Superflex. I'm going to ignore Seismic.
That's okay.
Stop it. Superflex. It would be a superhero.
Yeah, I would.
You know,
Kara, Superflex. Well, he's going to tell us about it. So tell us quickly about your background in robotics. You worked in robotics for a long time, and at one point you were the director of robotics at SRI.
That's right. Yeah, so I started out in robotics doing graduate work, like a lot of people, and I have a PhD in robotics, but quickly realized
MIT,
I wanted
Cambridge,
England is my PhD.
Okay, all right.
And I... quickly realized I didn't want to do research and was more interested in commercialization. And ultimately, that led me to the position at SRI, where I was running the robotics lab there and responsible for their DARPA programs, but also for what attracted me there was spinning out technologies and starting new companies.
Explain SRI for people.
SRI is formerly Stanford Research Institute. It's I think it's celebrating its 75th anniversary this year. It's really an amazing place. And I gave a talk at my kids' high school 2 years ago in their technology week and asked how many people knew SRI. And the only two people that raised their hand were my two sons who were sitting in the audience. It's a shame that people don't know
it's
about
wonderful.
It. But, it's a nonprofit and it's essentially a spinoff from Stanford University. But they do contract research. So their business is to do research for other people that want to pay them to do research.
And I think I saw some surgical robotics there. It was cool. It was such a cool
place. That's right. So the the group at SRI that I was managing was where the Da Vinci system was developed and mm-hmm. spun out. But when the internet, I like to say, was two computers, one of them was SRI. And mm-hmm. And from that starting point, they just have dozens and dozens of new technologies they developed.
And you were working on a robotic warrior suit for DARPA?
Yes. Yeah,
DARPA is the defense. Explain DARPA. We should
So the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, it is the part of the Department of Defense that funds advanced research, and its main mission is to just avert technical surprise. So after Sputnik, the military wanted to promote investment in a way that would allow the U.S. to just constantly be out in front in terms of technical mm-hmm. innovation. And so pretty much every technology that's surrounding us right now was at some time invested in by DARPA.
Yeah, it's really, we had Regina Dugan on stage many years ago at All Things D, I guess, and she talked about the Mach, whatever, a 10 airplane or something.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I remember Pat Lincoln, when I first went to SRI, he's running the computer science lab there, just saying that to him, DARPA is the best use of his tax dollars that he can think of in terms of the impact. But this this Superflex program that we were running at SRI was our project as part of a DARPA program called Warrior Web, which was a wearable robotics program that was an alternative to exoskeletons. So something that was more lightweight and focused on reducing injuries and fatigue for soldiers carrying heavy backpacks than it was leaping over tall buildings or carrying big heavy loads like you often see in Aliens or other science fiction
movies.
Or a
Jean-Claude Van Damme movie. Did you see that movie?
No, I didn't.
What was it called?
I mean, I've seen Iron Man.
Jean-Claude Van Damme had a movie where he was wearing an exoskeleton. It was fantastic.
Kara, you look excited by it. I think Kara
wants one. I've seen it 17 times.
Well, let's bring it back quickly because we're talking about powered suits, exoskeletons, all this stuff, and by the way, shameless plug, on the latest episode of Next Level, my Verge video series, we actually talked to Rich and other experts in the exoskeleton field and wearable robotics field all about exoskeletons. So you should go check out that video. But for people who don't know what an exoskeleton is, talk about that and then talk about how what you're doing is a variation on that.
Right. So Seismic now is bringing to market something we're calling powered clothing. And it is a form of wearable robotics like exoskeletons. Exoskeletons are bigger, bulkier. They're skeleton frames that you wear around your body. They're stronger motors that are helping to carry the body. And the early applications beyond being able to help in construction and lift heavy things are for people, for instance, with spinal cord injuries, to be able to carry the body and help them be able to have therapy and learn how to walk. And in our case, and what I saw, and the reason I ended up leaving SRI to lead this company, was we developed under that DARPA program some more lightweight actuators, electric muscles that we were integrating into clothing. And I like to make the point that, like, all of us in this room right now are wearing clothes. None of us are wearing robots. So
you can tell them the truth.
Yeah.
None of us are wearing clothes in this room right now.
No, we are, because we find it's appropriate to dress in the workplace. Thank you. That's been an ad
sorry
for
to interrupt.
No more sexual harassment. Anyway, but these are, because a lot of wearable clothes, when you think of powered clothing, you think of those idiotic t-shirts that light up and some of the ones that are going to track you or your sweat or your heartbeat or things like that. This is different.
Yeah, so we thought about like maybe actuated apparel as a way to describe it, but we thought that was kind of too technical. And so powered clothing isn't really used to describe.
Exoskeletons. I'd like to keep all your names.
I know, exoskeleton is cool, but it also does just create an image of something that's heavy and non-consumer oriented. I think that's the other thing we were trying to do is we do want something that's more consumer oriented and so the idea of powered clothing is just to think about, like, we're integrating this extra strength, wearable strength is another way we describe it, into clothing. And we really are a clothing innovator. We want to add new functionality to clothing.
How about super clothing?
I actually like Super Suit.
Don't like their name.
Seismic Suit? That's something
where, suit. Oh, I like that.
Yeah,
I think
I'm okay with people referring
seismic
to it that way.
Seismic Suit is good.
But one of the things I noticed when I visited their lab down in Menlo Park not too long ago for this Verge episode we were taping, and one of the things I noticed that was very different about your lab versus some of the other exoskeleton companies I've seen is that those feel like very industrial kind of workspaces, and the product is kind of something you have to like attach on, and they're soft goods, but they're also like hard goods and metals against the body. Your place looked like a fashion house, like just in the way things were sort of laid out and designed. It was like it's like seeing like, you know, racks of clothing around rather than metal parts.
And that was intentional. So part of it that came from the DARPA program wanting to create something that was more lightweight. But when we started to put the company together, we realized that going back to like clothing is something that people know. We want to innovate around clothing. And we built our team around apparel, fashion, textile, design. And then we come from a robotics lab, so we definitely have hardcore robotics capability. But our workspace, as you're describing, it's half of it is apparel development, sewing machines, big white tables, lots of fabrics, materials, mannequins everywhere. And the other half is benchtop, electromechanical workstations. But for me, what's most exciting about that is the space looks cool, but the interaction of the teams. And when I talk about powered clothing, to me, it's not just this technology that is our product. It's also it's a new type of company. It's a new type that's this interaction of this fashion apparel design and this electromechanical design.
Could you give examples
design.
Of what you'd use? I'm going to geek out because a lot of the people think of superheroes, and it sounds dumb, but they always think of what's on the suit and what it does for them.
Yeah.
They're lightweight, right? It was just when the Justice League.
Well, imagine
the Flash's clothes had special.
Mm-hmm. I'll let Rich answer because he's the expert, but imagine, if you're not looking for superpowers or to lift 200 pounds during your day-to-day, but imagine you have a hip problem, right? I would imagine, or a knee problem or mm-hmm. something like that. And then you're like, I just need a little extra. I just need a little boost.
Yeah.
Right?
Muscular dystrophy. He would love clothing.
Yeah, so we actually have a program where we're working with a group to develop a suit, evaluating it for kids with muscular dystrophy. So mm-hmm. that makes perfect sense. So that's how to think about it. Wearable strength, we have electromechanical muscles that are integrated into clothing in alignment with your anatomy. And there are sensors, inertial measurement units, IMUs, that are the same thing you have in your phone that are tracking the movement of the body. And then they turn on the muscles as you're moving to align with
your
movement.
These electric muscles.
They're electric muscles. So it's all battery powered. So
is it the clothing that moves or the body?
Yeah. So it's the clothing has muscles that are harnessed to the body. So think about compression wear. Right. That's grabbing the body. So if you go inside your body and think about how muscles grab your bones and they contract in order to help you move, our muscles do the same thing. They contract and they're grabbing the body. And as they contract, they're contracting with your hip muscles to provide extra strength. So think about a power electric bicycle. So when you're pedaling, that you get this extra power. Now think about I'm getting up out of a chair and I have these muscles that are working in my clothes to add extra power assist for me to help get up out of the chair.
Right. And what else? What other things?
The product is focused on the core, and so we're really looking at, and it's a programmable suit, so mm-hmm. initially we're looking at things like standing support, so people that are on their feet for a long time. We're focused on the core initially because we do see the senior population as a really strong initial market, but anybody that's kind of working hard and develops fatigue around their core muscles from standing all day or...
So jobs.
Any kind of job, a sales job, someone behind a counter all day. We have a lot of activity in Japan. There are the average age of a construction worker in Japan, for instance, is 48. And so we're talking to a lot of companies in Japan about how we can build some powered clothing solutions to support the workers there.
Mm-hmm. Wow, amazing. So let's talk about things.
Let's talk about robotics.
Robotics.
One of the
general,
things that we put out a call for questions around was this idea of robotics and how lately they seem to instill a lot of fear in
jobs.
People. You may have seen the Boston Dynamics backflipping robot that people went nuts about on Twitter. In fact, I saw one tweet that went viral where someone just simply said, "We dead," when they saw that was it. May have been Kara Swisher. Why do you think people, and then of course we'll get into what this automation and robotics means for jobs, mm-hmm. but why do you think people have had such a strong reaction to this Boston Dynamics robot?
Yeah, I think so there is already a ton of automation in the world and people don't really react to that, right? And so I think it's because those robots are starting to look like us and people relate to them somehow as being superior, physically at least, and then with all the AI talk as well, that there's from an intelligence point of view, that they could be superior to us. And that creates fear. And so, and then on top of that, there's just a whole body of science fiction. Like the first movies, the first use of the word robot was about a play where robot workers overcame their human masters, right? So even the origin of the word evokes that kind of fear. Right. So I think it's just, it's part of the culture. So I don't think there's any way to move past it. I do know from working in Japan that that is not part of the culture in Japan.
Yeah, they love robots.
Yeah, they love it. They're not afraid of them. When I talk to our Japan staff, they are kind of don't even understand. They have to take them a little while to understand, oh, so people are afraid of robots.
Well, where's it from? I mean, but one, there's definitely, I just was visiting an Amazon warehouse and I was like, whoa. It was the same to me as backflipping robots when I saw those things moving around. I was like, whoa. Like right. it was sort of scary and fantastic at the same time. I had both feelings. And I think that's how people felt about that robot. It was like, wow, and whoa,
Right.
kind of thing. I think it's from movies and Terminator probably the most, but there's a million movies robots kill us, and there's just a few where they're nice to us, essentially.
But there's also that uncanny valley thing too, where Rich touched on a little bit, that idea that because they're getting more, I don't know if you would use the word human-like, I don't want to use that, you're right, they're starting, like you look at some of their, the way that their limbs are moving and the way things are sort of shifting, and there's something very fluid about it, and you think, oh, that's human-like.
And also with Elon Musk talking about it, he's always, I mean, he did a We Dead around that one too. He's always
I think he responded to that one that you haven't seen anything yet.
So. Yeah.
Where do you put the Boston Dynamics robots on the scale of Uncanny Valley?
So when I saw that video, like I was energized by it. Like I definitely wasn't afraid of it. I didn't react to it in the same way. Like so when we were at SRI, when I was at SRI, we actually had another DARPA program where we built a humanoid. And what I saw in that, I knew where some of the component innovation was occurring that was allowing them to do that. And I was excited that they had reached that point. But I also, I didn't just look at it. I went to their website and I wanted to just see what the latest was on the website. And actually, I was interested in the fact that they actually have specs on it there, that it weighs 75 kilograms. It's battery powered. It can carry, I think, 11 kilograms. And so that's actually what I was really wanting to see, is because they were just purchased by SoftBank. You know, there's tons, you know, basically you have another organization with a bottomless pit of money because they're bought from Google, is now owning them. And money is not the issue, right? It's really what are you doing? How are you figuring out how to transition this to something that's useful? So the big question that I have is just the battery, is like, how long can the battery last? Because that's what I tell people. If you're worried about robots right now, then just unplug them or just wait till their batteries run out in 15 minutes. Like that's the classic issue that everything has. And until we figure out, the arc reactor, part of the equation, we're really not going to be able to do, we're going to be limited in what robots can do.
Right. That the humanoid robot that you worked on for DARPA, was that ever deployed?
No, so that specifically was to look at this issue of power efficiency. And so we built a humanoid that had a human-like gait that could walk for 7 hours on a single battery charge. And when you look at a robot that can do that, we didn't invent any new batteries. We actually went back and just looked at all the parts. And the other thing I saw in what Boston Dynamics has done, and I think what we're seeing, I think we're doing this a little bit in our approach at Seismic, is that the last 25 years of robotics development has really been about how industrial grade robots and robot technology is trying to be applied outside of those industrial applications. And what we're seeing in some of these new robots that we haven't seen before is really new kinds of components, robotic components that are enabling robots that are more able to work in safely with people or able to do different types of activities. And so every industrial robot that you ever see in a factory is plugged in. Power is not an issue. Mm-hmm. The efficiency of power isn't an issue. And no one's really thought about that before. So Gil Pratt, when he was running DARPA, the robotics work at DARPA, had programs on efficiency of those, and going to things as simple as gears. Can we make gears that are more efficient for these applications? Our gears and our joints are very efficient as humans. There's almost no friction there, and so we're not losing power to gears. But any kind of industrial robot is very inefficient that
way.
Do
you do? I want to get off the jobs things in a second. But do you do any hire any anthropologists or sociologists to talk about it too? Because that's one thing that seems left out of that. I know Google, for example, is working with anthropologists on VR, for example. Like there is, and I think one of the things that you're seeing now in some of these issues around social media and the weaponization of social media is that they never thought, you know, like for some reason, these people never thought that there were some societal issues related
right.
to
right. It's
it.
Like humans were left out of the equations to
yeah,
provide a service
like, oh,
to humans.
Yeah, like, oh, it's cool. And I could see it because yeah. I know a lot of the people at MIT and, you know, I know lots of robotics people and they just, the cool part takes over to the point where it's maybe not so cool
right,
to
right.
everybody.
Yeah, and I think, so our answer to that question is we have biomechanics experts. So we are just looking at how the body moves and how can we integrate our components into clothing in a way that works well with the body. And then from the sort of anthropological point of view, we're looking at just traditional industrial design, user experience. And so we are we have industrial designers. We're actually recruiting
a
user.
They try to make them cute. I mean, I've seen so many robots that are like adorable or fat or something.
Yeah, and it's really, and I think that's part of also.
That's
what you need to have successful products, right?
What's the Star Wars one, the fat Star Wars one, the tall, skinny one? He's the fussy
R2-D2?
One.
Yeah.
C-3PO. Or Pepper, speaking of SoftBank, their robot Pepper is like, it's quite adorable. It's a retail robot, so it's supposed to greet you and it's supposed to help you buy things once you're in the store, but it's like, it just looks adorable.
Can I ask a strange question? When I was at MIT many years ago, because they're all in, the robotics is a big deal there. One of the things someone who was actually a cogent human being was talking about was the eyes, that they had problems with the eyes always, and that was one of their, they were doing a medical one to talk to patients through simple problems, because I guess the top 20 issues in an emergency room are all the same, essentially, and it's very easy to just diagnose and move people out so you can get to the real cases.
Right.
And so they said the people had a problem with the eye. That's why people, they were better in every way except they didn't have a human.
Yeah, and when you look at this social interaction between people, the eyes are so important, and I think that was definitely overlooked in early robotics work. And then there's been a lot of work, especially at MIT, Rodney Brooks, Cynthia Brazil, recently, has done that work. There's actually an approach in robotics where there's just a screen for the face, and you can actually put a human face there or some other
You've
kind of
seen that
eye
in
animation.
These rolling around ones. Yeah.
Right. And I think it's just part of this evolution that has to occur that I don't think has been solved yet. So robots don't have to look like people, but the ones that you want to look like people for them to be accepted,
caregivers.
They have to solve those kinds of interpersonal issues. And it's still evolving. I haven't seen a robot yet that I think would be accepted into everyday life.
Should we talk about jobs?
Jobs, yeah, we should. But also, it's also. I'm curious if you like the depictions, the media depictions of robots as a person who, because then we'll get into jobs because it's leading into this work.
Yeah. So I actually have I've given a number of interviews and a lot of times they're not. Video recorded in real time, but I'll still give you my reaction. But there's a lot of reporters that will start and they'll go right to that jobs question, and I'll be like, really, that's your question? Like that question's been asked forever, and it's been answered a million times. You're like, don't you have a better question for me than just going back to the old jobs question? And so. I do think the
people that are having their jobs replaced like it, so that's why we keep doing it.
Yeah, and I think it is that's not necessarily always the fact of what's happening.
No, I
think there's, but it's hard to tell the story of what actually is happening, right? It's not as easy as saying you just say jobs and people can react to that. Where the story of what's actually happening is just a little more complicated,
it's more nuanced than that. Oh, introduce robots to market, therefore replacement. It's
right.
I mean, this is a we. We've interviewed a lot of people
they all talk about it like that, though. So,
well, yeah, and there tends to be sometimes, from covering Silicon Valley, there's a little bit of a techno-utopist approach to, well, robots are just going to help us level up, right? So the problem is not that the jobs are being replaced. The problem is you need to figure out how to level up because the robots are going to allow you to do something else. And I think that's that may be true in some ways, but it's a hard pill to swallow for people who maybe feel like they're getting phased out of the workforce as well.
Right.
But the truth is also that automation has existed in factories for a long time now.
Right. So, and
with
we talked
about social unrest attached to it, which Silicon Valley, I've had this long running debate with Mark Andreessen, and you just did it on the stage. You know, there's social unrest that they tend to overlook.
Right. And so, part of my answer is that I think people already know that that somehow robots will impact the workforce. Mm-hmm. And most of our thoughts around that are just reacting to it.
Sure.
There's not good planning from
a government
point of view,
yeah,
or even an understanding of how things will evolve. And I don't have a economics degree, but I look at, you know, our democracy was set up 250 years ago, and we created this economic structure that was based in technology and understanding 250 years ago, and we have technologies now that could let our economy work differently, or we could use those technologies and manage them in a way that let our economy work differently. I tend to look at robotics as affecting quality of life and the quality of what we're doing, not jobs, and that we tend to focus on the people that have jobs, and we tend to focus on our country where jobs drive the quality of your life in general, but the world overall, there's lots of people that aren't living a high quality of life, and even two people that have the same dollar in their hand don't have access to the same quality of healthcare
point.
And education and other things like that. And I do think robotics can help to create more equality in terms of the standard of living that people have. And in some ways, it's already happening in manufacturing. If you accept that the use of robotics in manufacturing has allowed the cost of durable goods to be cheaper, like our cars cheaper.
Well, someone always benefiting.
Right, so more people are able to buy cars that are high quality with the same dollar than they would otherwise if we weren't using automation to maintain quality and
the fact
that
some jobs are repetitive and not...
Right,
should not be done by human beings.
Yeah,
we get that.
Yeah, I think that's totally so my perspective on jobs is actually when I was at SRI, one of the trends that I saw really early, because we were doing DARPA work, but we also were doing contract work for companies that wanted to see robotics developed to solve some of their problems. And what I was seeing is that they weren't coming in and saying, we need to reduce our costs and let's get rid of workers. They were saying, we can't get enough workers. Like manufacturing is experiencing this in China and the U.S. and other places. Like there's huge turnover. There's lots of safety issues. The new generation, and this happens in every developing economy where manufacturing drives standard of living, that the next generation doesn't want to go to the factory every day. So you end up, what I was seeing is across like mining and agriculture, manufacturing, retail, that people were trying to find robotic solutions to fill what I refer to as a labor
job
gap.
Loss. There are jobs. It's interesting. It's an issue. I think the issue is a lot of people, you know, when tech told us social media would just be great 100% of the time, it's turned out maybe not to be so much, or the government was supposed to be paying attention to jobs when they're not even paying attention. That's really the issue, is they're not even thinking about it.
Right. It's hard. It's hard to figure out how to shape the economy around what jobs can offer
or what jobs should
or
be.
How jobs can evolve from based on robotics.
Yeah. It's a big topic. We're going to talk about, we have tons of great questions from our audience. We're not giving you a hard time, Rich. We're just, it's a worry.
Yeah, it's part of my...
I'm so sick of listening to Silicon Valley people some days.
It's an occupational hazard for me. I don't go out to dinner.
Twitter is
going to
be great. Oh, really? Oh, God, what did Donald Trump do today? Something awful again. In just a minute, we're going to take some questions about the future of robots from our readers and listeners, and Rich is going to answer them. But first, we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor, Lauren.
Touching.
All right, that's good.
I am your robot overlord.
You're doing like... Danger Will.
Can you put
Robinson.
An effect that on that? That I just said that. Okay,
is that
cool.
A Danger Will
what you
Robinson
just heard
voice?
Was my
then
real
I'm
voice.
I'm dating myself with Will Robinson. We have to think of a new thing besides Kaching for 2018.
That sounds good.
Let's put a pin in that. Let's put a pin in that.
All right. Let's do it.
Today's show is brought to you by Simple Human. Their goal is to improve the way people go about day-to-day tasks, one innovative product at a time. They sent me their latest product to try, and it's really cool, and I like it a little too much. It's a touch-free motion sensor trash can that you can also control with your voice. I am driving everyone at my house crazy talking to the trash can. If you've got a mess of stuff you need to throw away fast or just want to toss a paper towel from far away, the Simple Human sensor can is for you.
The can is tested to last more than 150,000 cycles. That's equal to 20 times a day. I do it like 50 times a day for over 20 years. In other words, bring on the trash. You can use your own trash bags or you can use the custom fit liners from Simple Human. They're stronger, neater, and they fit perfectly. So if you're anal retentive like I am, you'll enjoy them. You won't realize how much you'll enjoy using one of these until you have it. And I have to say, I really am enjoying it more than I thought I would. They're available in a single bin or with two compartments for recycling. And Simple Human Sensor comes in five beautiful different finishes: brushed rose gold, white, black, stainless, and dark bronze. Visit simplehuman.com to purchase your sensor can with voice. Enter the promo code ASK at checkout to receive 15% off any of the sensor cans with voice. Again, use the promo code ASK at simplehuman.com for a discount on your own voice-controlled sensor can. We're back with Rich Mahoney, the founder and CEO of the wearable robotics company Seismic, which I like to call Superflex. We're talking about the future of robots, and no surprise, our audience has a lot of questions about that topic. We got a ton of people love robots.
So many questions.
Yeah. Lauren, would you read the first question?
I'd be happy to.
We have areas to talk about.
The first section is really about robot safety, the uncanny valley. Elon Musk's comments, because we just can't seem to get Elon Musk out of our podcast
these days. You know what would be a mindfuck? I bet Elon Musk is a robot, and then he's doing it to make us hate robots so that he could be the only... Anyway, just thinking out loud.
Elon, you're welcome to come on the show anytime.
Now he's going to really
even if you're a robot.
Yes.
All right, the first question is from Brianna Wu.
Great, Brianna Wu.
She says, hi, Brianna. She says, because I'm a Boston resident and I don't have access to a 40-watt phased plasma rifle, how can I protect myself? We're getting right into it.
You see, it's not just
us. How could she protect herself?
Rich, it's not just us.
Right, so today, just wait 15 minutes or unplug the robot. Like, it's, don't recharge it. Like, and that's the biggest, there's not a battery solution that will let robots do, like, pick any movie that you want of a robot destroying us, and the power supply for those robots.
They take over the electric grid secretly.
That's right.
So if they Terminator,
right. But they still.
Yeah, but haven't you seen Short Circuit with Johnny Five?
So that's my. Alive? So I always say just unplug them. Like, just wait them out.
That is not good enough. I think. I think everyone should have a 40-watt phase plasma rifle.
Yeah, that's really reassuring, Brianna. Actually, when you think about, like, these, you know, giant war robots with human-like gears who can destroy us all. Just unplug it.
Yeah, that's what I
write. Damn thing.
I always say, well, what's the battery?
Wander around airports and plug themselves into
things. All right, ask what's the battery.
Next question. Pranav at Mr. Pranavesh. Everyone says that humans are in control of AI and can turn AI off if something goes wrong, like a kill switch. My question, what happens if AI learns how to disable or override the kill switch? Is it possible? It's literally all the Terminator people, my base. Mm-hmm. I have a base.
Yeah, so apart from the going back to, like, just turned it off, you know, I think that the other thing to look about, and I actually think about, and I really like the looking at how technologies actually really do become adopted and a part of our society. And I read a book, The Age of Edison, a little while ago. I don't know if you know it, but it was about from the invention of the light bulb to when the country was fully electrified was about 10 years, which is kind of ridiculous. You think about, we went from having no electricity and to having a light bulb and then all of this this technology. But if you follow what happened there in terms of, like, there was just this crazy period of wires being run everywhere and people dying from wires falling on them and no regulation. And then from that mayhem emerged regulation and, reaction to how... at some level, like what Elon is saying, will happen. Like, cars are regulated. They're, nuclear technology is regulated. Like, we learn from the technology, and it's not like we're going to be like, why did we suddenly decide not to regulate this technology if it was somehow affecting us? And then the other part of it is that if you think about AI, because then there is this view of AI that there's emergent behaviors. We don't know what we don't know about what can happen with AI. And so I accept that, but at the same time, right now it's not pervasive. It's not like we all, iRobot, the movie where everybody has this humanoid robot in their house. Yeah, when we get to that day, like, we better make sure that we have some fail-safes there, that those robots aren't taking over. But today, we don't have that. And so there's a lot of time between now and then for that to happen. And regulation and understanding will emerge during that time.
We'll see. Until then, 40-watt phase plasma rifle, please. Next one.
This was a good question, and there was a little video linked to a GIF link to it that you can't see because you're listening to a podcast, but I'll explain it. This is from Ian Fay. How is it that I am terrified of our upcoming Terminator future? Yeah, I feel viscerally horrified when someone kicks a robot like this. And then he linked to a video of someone kicking up one of the robot dogs, right? So that's a good sort of psychological or sociological question. Like, why is it that we feel bad about, right? Do robots have a soul?
So, so we can, I don't know if I can answer the soul question, but I think the, when you look at people have a personal relationship with their cars, they have a personal relationship with so it's part of being human to actually relate to things and to somehow give them human emotions. And I think when you have something like this robot that is even more like us, that it's just it's built into our DNA how we interact in that way. And so I think that is really natural. Like I think it's, and I've faced this when early in my career people were looking at how could you use robots as social devices for the senior population. I would be like, well, that's inhumane. They should have people coming and talking to them. Well, if people aren't available, there's a lot of older people sitting in homes staring at walls. Why isn't it okay if they get value from some kind of robot or other interaction that's not not real, but still bringing value to them? So I think you have to always go back to what's real that way.
We attach our emotions to things. I had this incident not too long ago when I was taping another video, and I was talking to a video of a Holocaust survivor. It's down at USC at the Shoah Foundation, where they've captured all these testimonies of genocide survivors. And they've applied their own natural language processing system to these videos so that you can have a very natural sounding Q&A. And at one point I interrupted the video and I apologized. I was like, I'm sorry. It just, and then I was like, I'm apologizing to a video because it felt so real to me.
Well, if you saw the new Blade Runner movie, there's actually a relationship between a robot and a animated a being that is like just a visual representation of a being, and we can relate to that as people. So it's
I think that was very easy. Yeah. We had a great interview with Jared Leto, who played the trillionaire, and how when he killed the replicant because it wasn't pregnant, I guess, just right away everybody was horrified, and Jared, I was like, how did you think about that? Because people, it was like a human being, and he said, oh, I just was throwing my iPhone at the wall, which I thought was a great answer, if you remember. I said that.
Oh, that's interesting.
You were there.
I know, I was there. I was
just staring at Jared Leto. Okay. All right, next question. Anyway, it was true. It was like, he goes, it's just like breaking an iPhone. Who cares? And it was a really great mental leap that he made there, I thought. This is from Kerry Watkins. Understanding that robots will quickly be moving into the healthcare space, how are companies dealing with the uncanny valley? Is it better to get your pills from R2-D2 or a robot that looks like a human? Oh, that's an interesting question. That's a design question.
Yeah, and I think that that's right. It is a design question. It's a product question. And so the reality is that just because you make that doesn't mean that the market will use it. And that's, you know, what I've learned in working on a lot of early stage commercialization is that if in the case where using the robot is better, it's because we built a better robot that people accept and solves a problem in a way that is better than what's happening now. So there's lots of low quality care and experiences in healthcare. So I think there's a low bar there at some level in terms of what we're trying to accomplish for people. But I think in the end, it's a product, and how good is the product development that was done?
Mm-hmm. Right. All right, this next question.
Well, there are lots of questions about Elon Musk's remark. So after this new video of the
back-flipping
robot came out, Elon tweeted, "This is nothing. In a few years, that bot will move so fast, you'll need a strobe light to see it. Sweet dreams, ... which is like as ominous sounding as you could possibly be. He's like, I am Tony Stark. And so people on Twitter, including Sally Kuchar from Curbed, who works with us here in the office, and a bunch of other people wrote to us when we said we were doing this episode, and they were like, what's he talking about? Is this a reality? Are these things going to be exponentially faster in just a few years?
Yeah, we've had Elon on stage talk about this quite a bit, and he threw everyone into a tizzy when he talked about the fact that we were in a simulation. That went forever. So he's always doing this. This is an Elon speciality. It's a trademark. TM, peak Elon. But, you know, he's done it a lot around AI, around robots.
Right.
You must all be like, that Elon, stop it.
Yeah, it doesn't affect my day-to-day for the reason I'm saying, like, we have to make a product. I have to make payroll. I have to, like, raise money for the company. I have to find customers. customers. So, but in terms of robotics in general, like I've talked a little bit about it, that there's a natural progression that's going to occur. It's not like we're going to wake up tomorrow and everyone opens their front door and there's a robot standing there. But there's also, like going back to what I said before about Boston Dynamics, is that there's a ground truth about what technology can do now. And if this robot is going to move at those speeds, then there needs to be a motor there that's moving it. There needs to be a power source that's controlling it. There's some technology that was shown from MIT recently for gripping and is really lightweight gripper. And then they talked about needing air. They're using air pressure to control it. Well, the compressor is part of that equation. And so we have to remember that it's not just that gripper. There's all this other technology that's behind it. I think the AI question is, I actually would make the case that AI is already regulated. And so the FDA, for instance, regulates all medical devices. If you're saying you're using AI somehow to solve a medical problem, that's any kind of computer code, any kind of electronics that is part of a medical device is regulated by the FDA. Yeah. So there's already processes for that. That's right. So it's already there. Yeah. And and robots themselves are already regulated. Like the robotics industry is regulated. Mm-hmm. So,
as our exoskeletons.
Yeah. So it's not like this isn't there already. It's just that it will evolve in a way that's responsive to what the technology can actually do.
We're going to move on to other things, but let me just say to that to all those people, there's always liquid nitrogen. Remember, just get yourself a liquid nitrogen pack and point it at that robot that's running fast, and you'll probably be okay.
You sound like such a prepper. Are you saying this from your bunker?
No, that's from Terminator 10. Thank you.
Okay.
But he'll also control who gets to go into space. So I think you shouldn't have robots on those spaceships, right? So people should just be able to go places where there aren't robots. So if they're really worried about
them. There's got to be robots in space. You got to bring them along. Come on. Who's going to go out and get the milk? I mean, all right.
I'm going to start doing pull-ups like Sarah Connor did.
Right. Oh, yeah. She's
just
great.
Be ready.
She's great. All right, Jane Thurber. Okay, this is about home care and elder care. Okay, as boomers age, how long until robots can help us stay independent at home, guide us on walks, monitor health biometrics? She needs this in 10 to 15 years.
Yeah,
so
we got a lot of questions about this.
Get on it, Rick.
You know, for the sake of time, I'll just read. All of these were very similar. We had one from Liz Nasty Weeks. Why isn't anyone talking about the possible efficiency and quality of life gains for home service care with robots? Mm-hmm. Paul Page, can the tech in these robots be used to replace or advance wheelchairs, walkers, other devices that help the disabled? And Tony Fratto says, when I'm old, I hope there'll be a robot to help me around the house, pour drinks, pick me up if I fall down. If it can do backflips too, I guess that would be cool.
So talk about the care thing, because it is an interesting area. And you're talking about also helping these robots. You wear them. Dean Kamen, I remember, had that seat that helped people get downstairs in New York who were in wheelchairs.
Most of my career before SRI, I worked in developing rehabilitation uses of robotics.
Right, the arm and the grabbing.
I'd done some work using robots for stroke rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. I actually understand that area. And what I would say is that I'd left, you know, probably one of the best jobs in robotics, running the lab at SRI, to do this company to solve the problems that they're talking about in that question. So we want this suit to be like where our initial focus is a wellness focus, but we want it to solve that problem. We want it to be available to people who are starting to lose strength. Because they're aging and being able to be more independent, live in their homes longer using this super suit, seismic suit technology. So it cuts both ways when you look at now going to what other kinds of robots, like a robot waiter or maid in your home, the Boston Dynamics technology that you're seeing is the precursor to those kinds of robots that can do more. And I think the thing that's missing in that robot, and then the thing what Boston Dynamics is really known for is walking robots.
So it's hard to do.
Yeah, and what they've done, and they are the best at it by bar none. And so, but what you're not seeing is arms and dexterous hands, and that's really one of the last horizons. And so, like the Amazon Challenge, if you're aware of that, what Amazon is interested in now, they have all these mobile robots. That they bought with Kiva, but they want hands at the end of those robots that can reach into bins and pick out one tube of toothpaste. Which people are now doing. Mm-hmm. And again, we have and we have issues with people having enough people to do it, and it's not a great job.
It's a really interesting.
So I actually think the arms. There's a company called Moly Robotics, which is touting a set of arms that are a kitchen device, basically an appliance that you can have over your stove, and they can make and prepare food for you. And there are two, they look like two human arms with a dexterous hand at the end. And I think that kind of solution, like I know it's difficult to build something that's consumer grade right now. We're getting closer and closer.
But so even timing, what's the time? I mean, Kiva is one of the most important acquisitions Amazon made. Yeah, I think so people don't think, talk about that.
Right, so think about this 10-year window that I just described. So even the iPhones that we all have, the smartphones, they took 10 years to become pervasive and also to create the kinds of applications that we're now seeing, and even still there's innovation. So if we say that within, you know, the next 5 to 10 years, we can see that technology, which I think we're right there. I've made this statement before that I don't think there's a technology hurdle there. I think there's a people hurdle. Like people ask me, what was the key to our success at SRI? It wasn't the technology, it was the people. And mm-hmm. it's always the people. And you know this when you're interviewing about companies here, it's really about the individuals that had the insight and that were able to apply the technology
to
the right way.
But in terms of technology, like, is this woman going to have a hurricane when she's 10 to 15 years old, or is she going to have a robot?
What do you mean by a hurricane?
Hurricane is a cane that old people use. It's very innovative.
Oh. Yeah, so
right. What it sounds like what he's saying is that with regards to home care, the dexterity of robot hands is really going to matter.
Yes, and movement. Exactly. I think movement is one.
So I think within 10 to 15 years, we will see the first of those products emerging, and that will be useful.
Advanced wheelchairs and things like that.
Yeah, so people have been working on that for a long time, and I don't know why we haven't been able to do better.
Wheelchairs.
So
they still use regular wheelchairs.
Yeah, it's just,
well,
I mean,
they work pretty well.
Yeah, I've seen better design, but like look at the technology we now are applying to cars. Why can't you get in a wheelchair and have it move you around? They are a form of robot in some regard. If you think about a mobile robot and someone's sitting in this mobile robot, but we haven't quite figured out how to integrate the technology.
The X-Men one was cool.
Yeah, it is.
It just looked like that.
Right.
They look terrible.
Yeah, and so that comes back to a lot of, like, even if I look at what I'm doing, I'm just in a startup trying to get, how do you get it funded? How do you get your first, that process of getting the resources mm-hmm. together, the team together, is part of the challenge in robotics to have this. So
yeah, wheelchairs are just so mechanical. They're not digital. They really are. I guess they just work.
And you look at, Google taking a shot at it. Mm-hmm. You've got Toyota putting a ton of money. You know, have SoftBank putting a ton of money. And so it's not the money, right? It's mm-hmm. it's some level combination of a technology platform and people that know how to transfer it out.
We have even more questions from our readers and listeners, but we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. We'll be back in a minute with Rich Mahoney from Seismic. Today's show is also brought to you by 8 Sleep. Have you noticed how many mattress companies there are recently? So many. One company is different from the rest, and it's called 8. 8 is smart. It's the iPhone compared to the flip phone. Unlike its foam counterparts, the 8 Smart Mattress is an innovative bed that uses real technology to help people sleep better and live healthier. By sleeping on 8, you can discover how many hours of sleep you need each night to feel energized. You can also optimize your day and night by connecting it to other Wi-Fi-enabled products in your home. Do you need coffee in the morning to function? Well, now you can program your smart mattress to start brewing your coffee the minute you get out of bed, I swear to God. The 8 Smart Mattress has everything to meet your individual needs. Visit 8sleep.com/TETA and use the promo code TETA to get $125 off all mattresses, plus free shipping and free returns. That's 8sleep.com/TETA to redeem this special offer.
Mm-hmm. Next questions. Go ahead.
These questions are about, well, we're back to jobs, but more broadly, industry and the economics of robots. Uni Sankar asks, why should a humanoid robot that backflips comically without earning a single dollar get all the attention when more than 300,000 industrial robots silently work 24/7 in factories worldwide, which impacts the bottom line of their owners and the top line of the vendors? I think he's more making a statement than asking a question, mm-hmm. but it sounds like he's saying these backflipping robots mm-hmm. are getting the attention, and meanwhile,
yeah. So the reason for that is I kind of alluded
Sorry,
to it earlier.
It's cool.
is that, yeah, besides that it's cool, and I definitely think it's cool. There's not a lot of those videos that I see that I think are cool, and yeah, no. That one I was excited about.
Did you like look at these videos like, ugh, so what?
Most of them, yeah. I've
been yeah. one of those robot snobs. Yeah, yeah. No, I know so them.
Yeah,
I know them.
I get my fix at
my
work.
My ex did a lot of robot mm-hmm. stuff, and she'd always be like, ugh, that's nothing. And
I was yeah,
like,
yeah.
what are you talking about? Just pushed a tennis ball up a hill.
Yeah.
So what?
And Megan would like take out a napkin yeah. and draw some design exactly. on it and be like, well, this is how it should work.
She right. wanted the robotics challenge.
But the that industrial automation that the question refers to is like a first case, and we kind of overlook it sometimes because we say industrial, mm-hmm. but it is a service robot application, people making things for other people, mm-hmm. and we started to use robots to do that in a way that yeah, at some level it was reducing labor, but it was we did it for a reason because we could make higher quality parts, we could make them faster, and so if you look at there was a chart I saw a few years ago that the cost of durable goods compared to any other product has leveled off since the mid-1980s. And the reason for that is because the use of technology automation has maintained a fixed level of cost for those things. So now you look at, again, the Boston Dynamics robot. Why is that important? Because we're starting to see now new technologies, not just industrial-grade technologies, but new component technologies in robotics that can serve the rest of the service industry, which is orders of magnitude bigger than manufacturing itself. So having robots that can go, like there's a company, Savioke, that does bellhop kinds of robots in hotels.
Yeah, the
in
ones
hotels.
That come to the door, room service. There's right. going to be, there's not going to be room service.
So it's remarkable because not only because it looks cool, but because you're saying that the components that are used to make those gears and make things work and stuff like that are inherently more accessible now yeah. and
right.
affordable.
Right.
Oh, I think room service robots is 4 years or 5 years. I think.
Yeah, they're already deployed.
They're deployed.
Already
restaurants,
right,
robot.
Right.
Restaurant.
Any mobile robot that's not manipulating something yeah. is just good business.
So this is one. Shouldn't robots pay taxes? I mean, this is an issue that I think it was brought up by Mark Cuban or someone was talking about this, or Bill Gates. How would society function in the future with more robots than unemployed humans? So shouldn't robots pay taxes? And then the second one, which we want to get through, is do you think there should be licensing requirements the way we have for those architects, engineers, and lawyers? How do we balance that against the employment opportunities created if the barriers to entry remain low? So let's talk about taxes and regulations.
Licensing.
So I don't think just a tax on service robots is going to be useful in any way, because I think anything that impedes the application of them in an artificial way, I think, is not necessarily good. So I think we do have to just look at what the real impact is on the economy. And like right now, I think that I was starting to say earlier that this service gap, there's a big demographic shift that's going on. The population is aging. It's already really intense in Japan and other Asian countries that there's not enough people to do the service jobs. And I actually think that gap is going to drive the innovation. Like there's a company in the Valley, Dishcraft, that is focused on dishwashing robots. It sounds just mm-hmm. very basic and simple, and why do we need this? But if you think about...
Sounds magical.
Yes, right. So imagine having that at home, but there's huge like industries that mm-hmm. restaurants and any kind of conference facilities all need that kind of technology.
Absolutely. All right, so that leads us to the last question. Go ahead.
Sure. The last question is from Steve.
I'm for robot taxes. I say yes. Mm-hmm.
But who's going to represent them?
They'll get some robot lawyer.
Saying taxation.
They'll be a real good lawyer. Robot lawyers, fine. And I'm good with that.
Or they're going to have to go to like robot school, like lawyers go to law school in order to get their license. There's going to be a robot bar exam. They have to meet the bar.
2 seconds to learn what it takes. My brother, 900 years to learn.
All right. Fine. Steve O'Dell, Mile High Devs.
All right. Last question for you. Rich has been so patient.
I know. He really, speak for yourself. I keep seeing U.S.-built robots doing cool stuff with questionable utility, while mm-hmm. Korea and Germany keep churning out products that immediately go to work. Mm-hmm. Where do you see the educational and R&D center of gravity in 10 years?
Yeah, we're stupid. We like them doing dumb things.
Yeah, I guess I don't see that, actually. I see...
I agree.
Yeah, I think the U.S. is absolutely the innovative leader in robotic application
true.
And development. So we're not always... I definitely see this, that we're not always the early adopters of that technology, and some of it is cultural, related to jobs and reaction to robots. So Germany, Japan in particular, both adopt our technology sometimes faster
than
we...
That's interesting. Why is that? I mean, is it because Cuban, I think, would get a thing saying that China could get ahead of us in these areas, and we're already at the forefront.
Yeah,
I
think so.
The worry was that.
Right, especially like China right now has much higher government support for the use of robotics. And in the U.S., we have this, you know, we have no support for the use of robotics. We actually have this issue that robots are bad, and politicians are afraid to talk about robots because of the job issue, right? And whether for better or for worse, it is what it is. And it means that the application, like if I look at Japan, there's actually subsidies for products for seniors, the robots that support seniors because of the demographics, because of the cultural views of robotics in Japan. Mm-hmm. So there are, it is something that we have to pay attention to.
Why is that? No, because our politicians are freaking idiots.
I do think that we need a view of robotics that isn't just a cultural reaction to them. And right now, there's not.
True.
Yeah, there's just not a good. The U.S. funds robotics. DARPA funds a tons of robotics. Our innovators drive. Boston Dynamics is in Boston, right? The people that came from MIT. It's an American company that is capturing the attention of the world. Mm-hmm. But as a country, we're not necessarily early adopters.
I think we're in peak technology hating right now. All I'm getting is books about how technology is going to kill us.
And for robots, though, that is definitely true. Other technologies, maybe not as much. And maybe people aren't realizing that there's automation there that's impacting us in ways that we're afraid of for robots, but I'm not totally mm-hmm. following.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's really interesting when you brought up Kiva Systems, which was also a Boston company that Amazon ended up acquiring and for their warehouses. Is like people probably aren't making the connection when they go to Amazon.com and they put, I want same day delivery, I want 2-day delivery, that they're experiencing a really great convenience.
Right,
but
right.
The place it's coming from is at least partially automated.
Yeah. Right.
Oh,
right.
Lots.
I mean, there's, you
go
can
look
go
at my
to
videos.
Food. I was
going
to say the food we eat every day, right. You know, if you're getting something from Big Ag, there's some process that's automated.
Yeah. There. And here's another thing to think about in terms of like what's going to happen is that innovation and the problems that like Amazon is focused on right now, this each pick problem. So, like before when the robots were solving problems in manufacturing, they kind of put them in cages and they stayed there. When Amazon solves each pick, this dexterous picking of things, now I have something that can do things in my home, they can do things in restaurants. And so I do think that the innovation that manufacturing and logistics are focused on now is going to open up more.
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be like AWS. It's going to be Amazon will have, you can't call it Amazon Logistics Services, a robot, ARS maybe. They'll be the ones that will.
You are in a name picking mood today. I like this.
What?
You're brainstorming today for names for things.
I like the
ARS.
We can't call it ALS. That's a terrible disease that this man perhaps will help solve. But in any case, this has been fascinating. And when we come back, we're going to talk about cyborgs and when we're going to get human looking. When's that happening?
Oh, I think it's already starting to happen, right? You're seeing it. Yeah, you're seeing it in the, Lauren was saying earlier, the robots are moving, robots
face,
are moving like people.
Like
oh, the
real,
face.
You know, like humans, ooh. That show. Do you like that show?
I do. I'm a science fiction nut. So yeah. Are there any kind of...
I'm rooting for the robot. I can't wait till they take...
Battlestar Galactica you're
yeah,
talking about.
No, humans.
I haven't spent much time with that.
Yeah, they're always mean to the robots, so I'm rooting for the robots. I can't wait till they wipe out the human race in that particular series, because they're real mean. The people.
I mean, that is part of the problem. Robots really won't do anything to us that people don't tell them to
Steven
do right now.
Steven Spielberg did a great film. It wasn't a great film, but it was an interesting about that, about the humanity. And of course, Blade Runner, you don't realize who's a robot and who's
right,
a replicant, which is interesting.
I have one more question before you let you go, which is if you are someone who's interested in getting in the robotics industry,
where do you go?
You know, you're looking
MIT.
At the next 10 years, are you looking, should be looking at programming robots? Should be looking at programming automated systems? Where are the jobs?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. And the thing about robots and that.
Just when I leave you, Kara, I'm going to go do robot stuff.
But that's just that robots are everything, right? So I look in my company, I've got electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, I've got data scientists, I've got software engineers, and I now have UX designers, I have public relations specialists, like as that robotics industry grows, like every aspect of business operations is going
to
be
needed. Someone to tell the story.
But what I always tell people is like whatever they're interested in, the best thing you can do, and that is really amazing in robotics now, is just make them. Don't like you can buy robot kits. You can there's so much available
to
you.
And the popular one this year, the little tiny round one, is super popular. What's it called? My kid wants one. Mini or There's a new robotics kit out this year. Yeah, it's real popular. It was in one of the purchase lists, or one of the lists. Yeah.
But that's why when I'm looking to hire people, I'm really looking for people that are just obsessed with making them, that they can talk about the different types of motors and the different types of software. And so there's it's so accessible. And so my access to robots came through science fiction. I read avidly growing up. There weren't really the clubs and kits that are available now. And so that's what I really tell people to do. And then just look for, and it's in every company also. Like all companies are really looking at, you know, I saw something recently about a new C-suite title called Chief Robotics Officer that companies, you know, automobile manufacturers have used robotics, but think about like Pepsi or whomever with their warehouse and logistics, they want to understand how to use robotics. So it really is going to be pervasive across all
industries.
And what's
the best school right now, schools?
Yeah, I mean, the top schools that are everybody knows, like MIT and Stanford and Berkeley for robotics. Carnegie Mellon has a really longstanding reputation for robotics. I think that there are lots of any good engineering school that and any kind of any good mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, computer science, computer engineering, all of those degrees are going to support are going to be useful for robotics.
And there's
robotics.
The robotics challenges like Dean Kamen does. What's that called?
First robotics.
Right? There's all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah, and there's so many people, so many young people that get to participate in robotics. And it's really great. Like even like if you look at high school clubs, again, it's not every person has to be a programmer, and you need someone who's a project manager. And I've got a son now. I'm advising for college, and I'm just like, you're so good at thinking about lots of different things. Like people, a mechanical engineer isn't necessarily a great project leader, and so we need people that can manage teams and think about the market. And I think there's a lot of opportunities.
So there's a growth area in building robots that will replace us. No, I'm teasing you.
That will enhance the quality of our lives.
I'm teasing you. We want you to come back and talk more about robotics and cyborgs in the future. We'll be back, right?
Yeah, maybe next time it'll be the real Kara, too, not a replicant.
I totally missed my joke. Eric got my joke.
Oh, I got the joke. Arnold.
I'll be back.
Arnold.
He's got to stop saying that, I think. And so do I. All right, this has been another great episode of Too Embarrassed to Ask. Rich, really, thank you so much for putting up with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Rich. And if you all enjoyed this week's episode as much as we did about our robot overlords, be sure to subscribe to the show, and you can leave us a review at itunes.com/Too Embarrassed to Ask.
And when you subscribe, you're the first to listen to new episodes every Friday or catch up on previous episodes. We answer all of the tech questions that our listeners have been too embarrassed to ask.
If you're not on Apple Podcasts, you can also subscribe to the show on Spotify, Google Play Music, really wherever you listen to podcasts. Or you can just go to the web, www.recode.net/podcasts.
There might be an HTTP.
It might actually be the easiest way to discover a podcast these days.
And while you're there, you should check out our other podcasts like Recode Decode, Recode Replay, and Recode Media with Peter Kafka.
The Verge also has some great podcasts. There's The Vergecast, which is our flagship, hosted by Neelai Patel. And we also have a new show called Why'd You Push That Button with Ashley Carman and Caitlin Tiffany.
You said that in a real...
Why'd You Push That Button? They did one... and everyone makes fun of the way I say button. That's fine. I'm used to it. But, you know, they did a good one a couple weeks ago about why people rewatch their own Instagram stories.
What?
Yeah, it's good. Just take a listen.
All right. I don't do that, but okay. And don't forget to tweet your questions ahead of time to @Recode or with the hat. That was just a what? Why'd you push that button? What?
You've been missing out.
I know. Don't forget to tweet your questions ahead of time to @Recode with #TooEmbarrassed or email them to TooEmbarrassed@Recode.net.
Thanks for listening, and thank you to our sponsors. Also, thank you to Cadence 13 and Vox Media, which sells all those ads. You can listen to this show for free.
Great.
Thanks to our editor, Joel Robbie, and our producer, Eric Johnson. We'll be back next week to answer more of the questions you've been too embarrassed to ask. So tune in then.